evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Wednesday, July 24th, 2024. Residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, say Wednesday's early morning gunfire sent a wrong signal. And Kenyan journalists protest police brutalities.
The rogue police officers who have been attacking journalists, action must be taken to them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sustained gunfire was heard in South Sudan's capital Wednesday morning. Military sources say there is no reason to panic following the shooting. Several narratives were put on the social media, including WhatsApp. And the dominant narrative that has been making rounds is that an officer who was driving at night refused to stop at a checkpoint, and it led to a shootout between police officers and some drivers who were armed. Sudan's paramilitary leader has announced plans to attend ceasefire talks in Switzerland next month, arranged by the United States and the Saudi Arabia. General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, head of the Rapid Support Forces fighting Sudan's army, posted a message on social media late Tuesday, responding positively to an invitation to talks expected to begin August 14 at an invitation at unspecified location in Switzerland. The Associated Press reports that the Sudan Armed Forces, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, says it has not decided whether to send a delegation to the talks. The U.S. State Department said the talks will aim to build on discussions between the two sides that broke down late last year in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday that the talks in Switzerland aim to reach a nationwide ceasefire, enabling humanitarian access to all those in need, and develop a robust monitoring and verification mechanism to ensure implementation of any agreement. He added that the talks do not aim to address broader political issues. Ugandan police detained several demonstrators in the capital, Kampala, in a crackdown on the opposition protesters. Douglas Mpuga reached Chesi Kabaga, a lawyer and a former executive director of Anti-Corruption Coalition in Uganda, to understand what is going on in the country.
The protest has happened. It may not have been necessarily in the big number that people probably would have expected. But I would say that the youth have used a rather interesting strategy whereby they haven't met at one particular place, but you've seen others coming from different locations, not necessarily organized, which I think for me is a plus. But of course, again, you wouldn't expect the big numbers because of the heavy deployment, the intimidation that government has put in place. Because, I mean, by yesterday, we saw quite a number of heavy artillery moving around town. So, and of course, for those that have managed to reach parliament, some of them have been arrested. But even those that haven't reached parliament, as long as they're holding placards, they have actually been arrested. The only, again, interestingly, some of the lawyers, I think, including the president of the Uganda Law Society, some of them have been denied access to those that have been arrested, which I would say is unfortunate and does infringe on a person's right to legal representation. But by and large, I think we haven't really seen fatalities like shooting at people. But of course, there have been some form of mishandling or manhandling of particular protesters. But in as far as loss of life currently, I don't think I've been able to see any online as per now.
We understand there's a lot of heavy military deployment and police, and as you said, some people were arrested. Are those who are protesting willing to continue given that intimidation?
I think they are, because there are quite a number of Twitter or say X spaces that are currently ongoing, and you can tell that the momentum is still on. They are actually saying they want also to continue tomorrow. So I think this is something that is most likely to continue. And again, when you follow what is online, the lawyers that I think that are on standby, see that who are willing to provide meals, the others that are willing to provide medical assistance. And the uniqueness, again, in what we've seen in this is that we've seen some others sporadically coming up, like in Hoima. I think the people in Hoima who are also engaging. So you may participate, but maybe as the week goes by, you may have others springing out in different parts of the country, not necessarily the capital.
That's Jesse Kabaga, a lawyer and the former executive director of the Anti-Corruption Coalition in Uganda. She was speaking to my colleagues, Douglas Mpogwa. Still on demonstrations, dozens of Kenyan journalists joined marches in Kenya today. They protested what they say is heavy-handed government tactics to silence the media, including police attacks on journalists during the demonstration that have rocked the country for the past 5 weeks. The French news agency AFP reports that journalists, many wearing white, held placards reading Journalist Lives Matter, Shoot Not the Messenger, and Brutality.
Today we've demonstrated that as media we can come together and demand that we are respected and to demand that our issues are addressed. And today we've delivered three petitions. First, the petition we delivered the Inspector General of Police to demand that journalists should guarantee their safety whenever they are doing their job. And number two, that the rogue police officers who have been attacking journalists, action must be taken to them.
I've said we are here to ensure that we protect the freedom of the media. That is why we are saying do not crush the messenger, trust the messenger. Like now, for example, in Parliament, they are calling for fresh accreditations and they are banning some of the journalists from covering Parliament. Just because we covered the storming of Parliament by the protesters, for us that is infringing in the rights and freedoms of the media. What we are basically telling the government and all other arms of government is that they must respect the freedom of the media, which is guaranteed under the Constitution. Article 34 of the Constitution guarantees media freedom.
We are banned. Who is going to let Kenyans know what is happening? In each and every day, the happenings in Parliament, it's freedom of us to tell Kenyans what is happening. However, we feel according to Section 34 of the Constitution, our freedom is being snatched from us each and every day. And we want to tell them we are not going to relent. We're going to be part of this movement until they agree to do what is right according to the Constitution.
These are voices of Kenyan journalists who marched to the streets in Nairobi today. Moving on African issues, John Mbaku, a non-resident senior fellow at Global Economy and Development with the African Growth Initiative at Brookings, says the African policy under President Donald Trump was weak. He says President Biden's approach has been more robust and Vice President Kamala Harris could continue the closeness that Biden started if she were to win elections.
A Democratic president would be better for Africa than a Republican president, because especially given the way the Republican Party is going these days, is looking inwards, has no interest in Africa. I think that it would be better for Africans to help elect a Democratic president in the U.S. because of the fact that the Democrats are more likely to promote better relations with Africa than the Republicans have indicated.
Since you mentioned the Democratic Party, can you actually specifically point out the closeness as well as the willingness of President Biden to actually make Africa part of his agenda?
Well, during his presidency, Biden made it clear that he was interested in helping Africans develop themselves. And of course, you can see that during the presidency of the previous administration, there was no interest in Africa whatsoever. But during Biden's administration, he was able to talk to Africans, and not only Africans here, but also Africans in Africa, and invite some of them to Washington to consult with him and give him an opportunity to understand the types of issues that Africans were interested in and try to put together a plan to help them improve the economic situation. So I think that during that period, his vice president was also involved in those negotiations. And I believe that if she becomes the next president, I don't see any reason why she would not continue that type of policy.
What else should Africans actually hope for in the coming election? We're seeing a lot of volatile happenings going on in the Horn of Africa, protests in Kenya, ethnic conflicts in Ethiopia, a civil war in Sudan. Does the presidency make a difference in bringing about at least peace for that area?
Well, I think one, what we have to make clear whenever we are talking about Africa is that in the end, whether Africa progresses or not must be determined by Africans themselves. There is no messiah coming to save Africa. Africans must save themselves. And you mentioned Sudan. Take Sudan, for example. There is virtually nothing any foreign power, no matter how powerful it is, can do to bring peace to Sudan. Peace in Sudan is going to be determined by the Sudanese themselves. As you can see, there are two generals in Sudan that are fighting each other. And over the last 2 years, experts have not been able to actually understand why the two of them are fighting and killing innocent people. And so anyone who had visited Khartoum, say 10 years ago, and visits Khartoum today, we realize that there is no Khartoum anymore. These people have destroyed Khartoum completely. And so you start asking yourself, what exactly are the two generals fighting for or about? And so one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that if Africa is going to develop, Africans, especially African leaders, have to change the way they look at politics and begin to understand that history will not judge them very well. Because many of them have had very destructive attitudes towards their own countries. So you see the same problem in Sudan. You see the same issue in South Sudan. You see the same problem in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, in Guinea. So the question, and in DRC, so the question I always ask myself is that what exactly are these African leaders trying to do? And so, yes, we need the international community, countries like the U.S., the European Union, to help Africa develop. But they can only do so if Africans themselves are willing to live together in peace and develop their own societies.
That's John Mukumbaku, a non-resident senior fellow for global economy and development with the African Growth Initiatives at Brookings. He talked to Yehia Wihup from the U.S. state of Utah. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, do you know how safe your roads are? Stay tuned for an answer to that question after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And our words of wisdom for today comes from Western Equatorial State.
I'm Daniel from Western Equatorial State, Yambio. My proverb is, "In pe rengo kubangili iraha." It means the truth must be spoken in front of the owner. This is the proverb I would like to share with you, John Taza.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The number of people dying due to road accidents in Africa has increased in the past decade, with 250,000 lives lost in 2001 alone. That's according to World Health Organization report on road safety 2023. The continent recorded 17% in road-related deaths between 2010 and 2001, despite being home to 15% of global population and 3% of its vehicles. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
The World Health Organization says road deaths in Africa are becoming a bigger problem compared to other regions of the world. Between 2010 and 2021, road deaths across the continent increased by 20,000. The WHO report released last week conversely shows global road deaths fell by 5% during the same period. Binta Sako is a WHO technical officer. She says the increased deaths are due to a lack of infrastructure and road users' behavior.
First of all, we are a growing population and, you know, urbanization without the infrastructures that follow is one of the reasons. The increased number of vehicles that are unregulated. We are the first importers of used vehicles, and most of the time they're not roadworthy. And then we also have to talk about the behavioral risk factors, you know, about speeding, about drink driving, where we have maybe less regulations around those issues.
Road users like motorcyclists, cyclists and pedestrians are most vulnerable and are at high risk of deaths and injuries. The WHO says the Africa region also has the highest proportion of pedestrian deaths, accounting for one-third of global fatalities. 29-year-old Samuel Amandi lost his brother to a hit-and-run driver in Nairobi.
So, brother, when you go to 2013?
He says my brother was hit by a car in 2013, and his body was found at 5 in the morning by pedestrians. The body was taken to the city mortuary. He says the mortuary followed up with his sister, and that's how we found him. Researchers say no African country has national laws that meet best road practices. TransAid is an international NGO that promotes driver training and government and training programs to improve road safety. Its head officer, Sam Clark, told VOA that training drivers to the required standard helps keep the driver and the other users safe.
You're improving access to training which meets the standard of many of the largest transporters in the industry, and therefore opening up the possibility of improved employment or access to new jobs. But also, by giving them better access to training, we are equipping drivers with a better ability, obviously, to come home safely at the end of every day.
Experts say the underreporting of road injuries and deaths in Africa is another challenge. Police records are a primary source of data collection, but not all road accidents are reported to police. Sako says accurate data on road crashes can help develop targeted responses and prevention efforts.
When we don't have quality data, is we don't understand what is going on. We don't understand why people are dying in the road. What caused those crashes? Is it, you know, is it poor infrastructure? Is it poor lighting? Is it alcohol? You know, is it the use of alcohol? So understanding exactly what is going on, and that is collecting data, so we know who really are the victims, so that we tailor our interventions to make sure that we respond to the needs.
17 countries in Africa have reported reduction in road fatalities, with other countries remaining stagnant or increasing. The UN targets cutting road accident deaths in half by 2030, but at the moment, road safety workers and activists lack the funding and knowledge to make that goal a reality. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Still on African affairs, a group of young African students is shooting for stars thanks to a program called Pathways to Space. Aerospace company Boeing and a South African science organization backed an education program that just celebrated its first batch of graduates. Vicky Stach reports from Cape Town.
Over 300 students from schools in Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Tanzania have just finished the 5 months extracurricular Pathways to Space program. In this theoretical and hands-on course, the students built and tested payloads for a high-altitude weather monitoring balloon. The goal was to send up a carton of eggs and have them return to Earth unbroken. Henok Tefera-Scholl is with aerospace company Boeing, the program sponsor. He says he's proud to be involved in space industry education in Africa.
This is a sector that will has a potential of transforming our continent, and we're glad to partner with those countries that have launched space programs, such as here in Ethiopia, in Tanzania, and in Nigeria.
Scholl says the program had to include 50% girls, and the program will continue to maintain this parity going forward.
And of course, in this area, the participation of girls is very important because they're heavily underrepresented. And we're also happy to see that it was a very diverse set of kids which came from all over Ethiopia.
Girl students like Helena Mulugeta say they love the program and want more opportunities.
I have participated in other programs, but nothing like this, because this has helped me apply the skills I know and the theories that I know, and it has also enhanced my knowledge in the aerospace engineering field and in other parts of space science.
Everyone,
3, 2, 1,
lift off!
The Ethiopian students marked their graduation with a high-altitude balloon launch from Sulalta, Ethiopia, on July 10. After 5 hours of flight, the balloon landed in Ambo, which is 186 miles west of the launch site. Organizers say all the eggs in the payloads returned uncracked. The Tanzanian and Nigerian graduation ceremonies are scheduled to be held on July 27th, also with high-altitude balloon launches. The program is an initiative of the non-governmental organization Future African Space Explorers STEM Academy, or FASESA. Boeing and FASESA say they will be expanding the Pathways to Space program to other African countries, and starting next year, we'll have both in-person and online training sessions. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town.
From Cape Town, we come back to Washington, where President Joe Biden returned to the White House Tuesday after an eventful news week that he spent entirely out of the spotlight, yet still managed to dominate with news of his exit from the presidential race, while his vice president hit the road launching her presidential campaign. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
It's awfully quiet around here. The White House was a hive of activity in recent weeks as President Joe Biden ramped up his re-election campaign. But with his recent withdrawal from the race this week, the scene has changed. Biden on Tuesday quietly returned to the White House after his recovery from COVID-19, as Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign took off. She hit Wisconsin on Tuesday. The opposing campaign of former President Donald Trump chose Tuesday to strike at both targets. Senator J.D. Vance is the party's vice presidential nominee.
History will remember Joe Biden as not just a quitter, which he is, but one of the worst presidents in the United States of America. But my friends, Kamala Harris is a million times worse, and everybody knows it. She signed up for every single one of Joe Biden's failures, and she lied about his mental capacity to serve as president.
In Washington, Secretary of State Antony Blinken extolled Harris for being, quote, a leading voice for American foreign policy and for our diplomacy. But he emphasized that Biden has a lot of work ahead of him, even as Harris campaigns to take the reins.
What he's intensely focused on is the work that remains over these next 6 months to continue the efforts, the work that we've been doing, particularly trying to bring peace to the Middle East, ending the war in Gaza, putting that region on a better trajectory.
Analysts agree. Naveen Nayak is president and executive director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
1/8 of his presidency is still left, and there continue to be real challenges both at home in terms of lowering costs, in terms of protecting consumers from junk fees, in protecting workers from terrible rules that benefit corporations, and overseas, trying to bring a ceasefire and a peace in the Middle East, trying to continue to push back against Russia's war in Ukraine.
And this situation also leaves foreign leaders in an interesting position, as Israel's prime minister is learning this week as he prepares to meet with Biden, Harris, and Trump. Jeremy Suri is a global affairs professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
Well, I do think Biden has one problem internationally, which is that foreign leaders know he's not going to be around after a few more months. And so they're going to be hesitant to make deals with him because they know that whoever comes next, and even if it is Harris, she is likely to have her own foreign policy team and her own set of aims. On the other hand, I think foreign leaders will want to accomplish things they can get accomplished quickly with Biden because they're not sure what will happen next.
For the second time this month, Biden will use the somber setting that is the Oval Office to speak live to the nation. On Wednesday night, he'll use it to tell his people why he made the very personal decision to step back. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
And we look forward to hearing from you about what we are doing well and what we should do well. Our number is +1 202-630-8011. I look forward to hearing your comments on Friday. That's all we had on our menu for you this Wednesday, July 24th, 2024. We now leave you with the song Pira Her by D. Coot. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Rob Macklin, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Bira ye ira korman wan ku bir chuko mit ke bay sudan mel ku ne biro biro kaneng ka korke biro kaneng mit ke re bira ye ukai kol chulun we wan ru nyang re ko tu we nyindu go kai bako ken wala ben nyang ru nyang re akola banda bira we nyang ru nyang re ben jam bo mit ke saw sudan nyang re wolun we nyindu go kay kot ka baye dong pan gro dong ku yak pingu yak jam nge jam yak jam we dorur yon panduk a jin dor ku ne ray mi ge ding dok mat ke jeng ben ben bi ya ban moy ta ko dakka tin dur war wo ni e pin no ma tin dur war wo yel ke wo to panda ge ki ni wo adona ga nga do bay tin ge gam wo yak ro dong re bi ay kay ko ki luñ me bañu ñëng rek wo tu way ñu dugo kay ba ko ke do le ben ñëng rek ak la banda bëra wi ñëng rek tan jam mo mi ke saw su ñëng rek wo luñ way ñu dugo ñëng rek wo kay ko ke ba ci dum pañ gëro ñëng rek ci jën to ke ka mu le ya cham ju yi bandu na ju di na tor be ki ka ñal long 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 a wa long 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 panay aku yak rudo ji tolo dem rap long 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 awaj awaj ko mit bi ko dum ki jak dem ken kawa awaj ne pan fe yang iran yin dengru dengre birae dengru dengre u kai ko ci luñ wey bañru dengre wo tu wey ñu dugo dengru dengre kai ba ko ke do le ben dengru dengre ak la banda gëra wey dengru dengre tan jam bo mit ke saw su dengru dengre wo luñ wey ñu dugo dengru dengre wo kai ko ke ba ci dum pañru dengre.